The road at this point had been roughly resurfaced, and was much more negotiable. We unhooked ourselves from the tank, and took on 8 or 10 of the engineers who had been riding on its back. Somewhat bewildered by this flood of soldiers, I had stopped the truck, and was looking for my company. Two M.P.s told me they thought it had gone on toward Kharkov, but as they weren't sure, they sent me to the redirection center, which had been organized in a trailer and was staffed by 3 officers, who were tearing their hair. When I was finally able to catch their attention through the thousands of shouts and gesticulations besieging them, I was harshly reprimanded for struggling. They probably would have sent me to be court-martialed, if they'd had time. The disorder was incredible, and the Lancer, half furious, half joking, flooded into the Russian huts. We might as well sleep while we wait for all this to settle down. All they wanted was a dry corner where they could lie down, but there were so many men crammed into each izba that there was almost no room left for the Russians who lived in them. Not knowing what to do with myself, I went to find Ernst, who had gone to look for information. However, he had run into a truck hospital, and had returned to the Tatra with an orderly, who was checking over our wounded. "They can go on as they are," he said. "What?" Ernst asked. "But we've already buried 2 of them. At least we should give them fresh dressings. Don't be stubborn and stupid. If I label them urgent, they'll have to wait their turn, lying in the street. You'll get to Belgorod quicker than that and escape the trap that's closing on us." "Is the situation serious?" Ernst asked. "Yes. So Ernst and I found ourselves responsible for 20 wounded men, some of them in critical condition, who had already been waiting several days for essential medical attention. We didn't know what to say when a man grimacing with pain asked us if he would soon be at the hospital. "Let's get going," Ernst said, frowning anxiously. "Maybe he's right. If I'd ever thought it would be like this." I had been at the wheel for only a few minutes when Ernst tapped me on the shoulder. "Come on, little one, stop. You'll finish somebody off if it goes on like this. Hand over." "But I'm supposed to drive, Ernst. I'm the one who's in the driver's corps." "Never mind. Let me do it. You'll never get us out of here." It was true. Despite my best efforts, the truck was jolting and sliding from one side of the road to the other. We arrived at the village exit point, where there was an interminable line of vehicles waiting for gas. Thousands of soldiers were walking up and down on either side of the road. An MP ran over to us. "Why aren't you waiting like everybody else? We've got to leave right away, Herr Gendarm. We're carrying wounded, and that's what the infirmary told us." "Wounded? Serious cases?" He spoke in the doubting, disbelieving tone of every policeman in the world. "Of course," said Ernst, who certainly wasn't exaggerating. "The policemen had to peer under the canvas anyway. They don't look so bad to me." There was a furious outburst of swearing. From time to time, wounded men availed themselves of their special position to abuse the police. "You son of a bitch," groaned one man, who was missing a piece of his shoulder. "It's shits like you who should be sent to the front. Let us through, or I'll strangle you with the one good hand I have left." The feverish Lancer was sitting up in spite of his pain, which made him frighteningly white. He seemed quite capable of putting this threat into action. The policeman flushed, and his nerve faltered at the sight of these 20 battered wrecks. The position of a big city policeman roaring at some pathetic bourgeois for going through a red light is a far cry from that of an MP behind the lines dealing with a gang of combat veterans who are holding their guts in with their hands, or have just bayoneted the guts out of somebody else. His display of bad temper turned into a set little smile. "Get out of here," he said, with the air of someone who doesn't give a damn. When the wheels of the truck began to turn, he vented the last of his spleen. "Go and die somewhere else." It was hard to get even 8 gallons of gas, and when we managed it our tank swallowed them in an instant. But we were glad to take what we could and get out. A feeble attempt had been made at surfacing the road, but there were still long stretches of bare ground which had become deep quagmires, to be avoided at all costs. We proceeded on the highway, or beside it, as circumstances required. Far to the right, we could see another convoy struggling forward in a line parallel to ours. The men were dressed for battle, and seemed to be prepared for an encounter with the Soviets. We were stopped by a new set of police, who combed our papers to see if they could find any mistakes. They checked the truck, verified our ID cards and our destination. But when it came to the destination, they had to give us directions. One of them looked through the directory hanging around his neck, and told us, in a voice like a barking dog's, that we had to turn off the road 100 yards ahead and proceed to Kharkov. We followed these instructions with regret, because the new road rapidly deteriorated into a ribbon of mire. At our speed, we would soon have exhausted our supply of gas. We kept passing vehicles abandoned in the mud because of mechanical failure, or because they had run out of gas. A short distance along the new road, we were stopped by a group of about 50 Lancer, on foot, and in a state of unbelievable filth. They took our truck by storm. There were several wounded men among them. Some of them had ripped off their filthy dressings, and were walking with their wounds open to the air. "Make room for us, fellows," they said, hanging on as hard as they could. "You can see that we haven't got any room," Ernst answered. "Let go." But we couldn't get rid of them. They swarmed over the tailgate, trampling on our wounded to try to make them move over. Ernst and I shouted at them, but it didn't do any good. They piled on everywhere. "Take me," whimpered a poor devil scratching at my door with bloody hands. Another waved a pass which was already almost expired. The arrival of a Steiner followed by two trucks restored order. An SS captain climbed out of the Steiner. "What's this, Antip? No wonder you've broken down. It's impossible. There must be at least 100 men here." The men scattered immediately, without asking for anything more. Ernst saluted, and explained the situation. "Very good," said the captain. "You take 5 more along with your wounded. We'll take another 5, and the rest will have to walk until the convoy comes by. Let's get going." Ernst explained that we would be out of gas in a few minutes. The captain signaled to some soldiers on the Steiner, who gave us 6 gallons. A few minutes later we were on our way again. We kept passing groups of men wading through the mud who begged us to pick them up, but we didn't stop. Toward noon, with our last drop of gas, we reached a town where a unit was being assembled for the front. I escaped becoming an infantryman before my time by a hair's breadth. We had to wait until the following day before we could use the reserve of 5 gallons of gas which Ernst was able to draw. We were about to leave, when an unexpected and unpleasant sound struck our ears. In the distance, still quite far away, we heard the booming of big guns. As we thought we were by now far from the front, we were both astonished and alarmed. We didn't know, and I didn't know until much later, that our course had been taking us parallel to the Belgrade-Kharkov line. Nonetheless, after unloading 2 dying men to make room for 3 more wounded, we set off without delay. In the middle of that afternoon, everything went wrong again. Our truck was more or less in the middle of a column of 10. We had just passed an armored unit whose tanks looked like a giant version of the slimy creatures that emerge on mud flats at low tide. They must have been on their way to meet the enemy, who seemed to be very close. We could hear artillery on our left, despite the loud laboring noises of the trucks. Ernst and L exchanged anxious looks. We were stopped by some soldiers who were setting up an anti-tank gun. "Dig in, fellows," shouted an officer as we slowed down. "Ivan's getting pretty close. This time, at least, they were telling us something." But I wondered how the Russians, who had been left some 90 miles behind, could already be in this district. Ernst, who was driving, stepped on the gas. 2 other trucks did the same. Suddenly, 5 planes appeared in the sky, at a moderate altitude. I pointed them out to Ernst. "They're Yaks," he shouted. "Take cover." We were surrounded by bare mud, with occasional clumps of stunted brush. There was a sound of machine gun fire from the sky. The column drove more quickly, toward a shallow fold in the ground which might give some protection. I was leaning out the window, trying to see through the flying mud spun by our wheels. two fock wolves had appeared, and had shot down two of the yaks, which crashed far to the west. Until the final stages of the war, Russian aircraft were no match for the Luftwaffe. Even in Prussia, where Russian air power was its most active, the appearance of one Messerschmitt 109, or one Focke-Wulf would make a dozen armored Ilyushin bombers turn and run. At this period, when German air power still possessed important reserves, the lot of the Russian pilots was not enviable. Two of the three remaining Yaks had taken flight, pursued by our planes, when the last dived straight at the convoy. One of the Focke-Wulfs was chasing him, and was plainly trying to get him in his sights. We reached the dip in the road. The Soviet plane had come down very low, to use its machine guns. The trucks ahead of us had stopped short, and the able-bodied were jumping down into the mud. I was already holding the door open, and I jumped, with my feet together, plunging face downward, when I heard the machine guns. With my nose in the mud, my hands on my head, and my eyes instinctively shut, I heard the machine gun and the two planes through a hellish intensity of noise. The sound of racing engines was followed by a loud explosion. I looked up, to watch the plane with the black crosses on its wings regain altitude. 300 or 400 yards away, where the Yak had crashed, there was a plume of black smoke. Everybody was getting up again. "One more who won't give any trouble," shouted a fat corporal who was clearly delighted to be still alive. Several voices joined in a cheer for the Luftwaffe. "Anybody hit?" one of the non-coms called out. "Let's get going, then." I walked over to the Tatra, trying to brush off the worst of the mud that clung to my uniform. I noticed two holes in the door I had opened to get out, which appeared to have swung shut on its own momentum, two round holes, each outlined by a ring of metal from which the paint had been scraped away. Nervously, I pulled open the door. Inside, I saw a man I shall never forget, a man sitting normally on the seat, whose lower face had been reduced to a bloody pulp. "Ernst?" I asked in a choking voice. "Ernst." I threw myself at him. "Ernst." "What?" "Say something. Ernst." I looked frantically for some features on that horrible face. "Ernst." I was nearly crying. Outside, the column was getting ready to leave. The two trucks behind me were impatiently blowing their horns. "Hey." I ran toward the first of the trucks. "Stop. Come with me. I've got a wounded man." I was frantic. The doors of the truck behind me swung open and two soldiers stuck out their heads. "Well, young fellow, are you going to move, or aren't you?" "Stop." I shouted louder than ever. "I've got a wounded man." "We have 30, one of the soldiers shouted back. "Get going. The hospital isn't too far from here." Their voices rose over mine, and the noise of their trucks, which had pulled out, and were passing me, drowned my cries of desperation. Now I was alone, with a Russian truck loaded with wounded men, and Ernst Neubuck, who was dead, or dying. "You shits. Wait for me. Don't go without us." I burst into tears, and gave way to a mad impulse. I grabbed my Mauser, which I'd left in the truck. My eyes were swimming, and I could barely see. I felt for the trigger, and pointing the gun at the sky, fired all 5 cartridges in the magazine, hoping that to someone in the trucks this would sound like a cry for help. But no one stopped. The trucks continued to roll away from me, sending out a spray of mud on each side. In despair, I returned to the cabin, and ripped open my kit to look for a package of dressings. "Ernst," I said. "I'm going to bandage you. Don't cry." I was insane. Ernst wasn't crying, I was. His coat was covered with blood. With the dressings in my hand, I stared at my friend. He must have been hit in the lower jaw. His teeth were mixed with fragments of bone, and through the gore I could see the muscles of his face contracting, moving what was left of his features. In a state of near shock, I tried to put the dressing somewhere on that cavernous wound. When this proved impossible, I pushed a needle into the tube of morphine, and jabbed ineffectually through the thicknesses of cloth. Crying like a small boy, I pushed my friend to the other end of the seat, holding him in my arms, and soaking in his blood. Two eyes opened, brilliant with anguish, and looked at me from his ruined face. Ernst. I laughed through my tears. Ernst. He slowly lifted his hand and put it on my forearm. Half choked with emotion, I started the truck, and managed to begin moving without too great a jolt. For a quarter of an hour, I drove through a web of ruts with one eye on my friend. His grip on my arm tightened and eased in proportion to his pain, and his death rattle rose and fell, sometimes louder than the noise of the truck. Choking back my tears, I prayed, without reason or thought, saying anything that came into my head. Save him. Save Ernst, God. He believed in you. Save him. Show yourself. But God did not answer my appeals. In the cab of a gray Russian truck, somewhere in the vastness of the Russian hinterland, a man and an adolescent were caught in a desperate struggle. The man struggled with death, and the adolescent struggled with despair, which is close to death. And God, who watches everything, did nothing. The breath of the dying man passed with difficulty through that horrible wound, making huge bubbles of blood and saliva. I considered every possibility. I could turn back and look for help, or force the men I was carrying to tend Ernst, at gunpoint if necessary, or even kill Ernst, to cut short his sufferings. But I knew very well I couldn't kill him. I had not yet been obliged to fire directly at anyone. My tears had dried, leaving the trace of their passage on my filthy face, to betray my weakness to the world. I was no longer crying, and my feverish eyes stared at the knob on the radiator 2 meters in front of me, which cut hypnotically into the interminable horizon. For long moments, Ernst's hand would tighten on my arm, and each time I was overwhelmed by fresh panic. I couldn't look at that horrifying face. Several German planes passed overhead, through the cloudy sky, and in a desperate attempt at telepathy, every fiber in my body appealed to them for help. But maybe they were Russian planes. It didn't matter, I had no time to spare. No time to spare. The expression assumed its full significance, as so many expressions do in wartime. Ernst's hand gripped my arm convulsively. The pressure continued for so long that I slid my foot off the accelerator, and stopped, afraid of the worst. I turned and looked at the mutilated face, whose eyes seemed to be fixed on something the living can't see. Those eyes were veiled by a curious film. My heart was pumping so hard that I felt actual physical pain. I refused to believe what I could guess without difficulty. Ernst. I shouted. From the back of the truck my shout was answered by several others. I pushed my companion down on the seat, imploring heaven to let him live. But his body fell heavily against the other side of the cabin. Death, he was dead. Ernst. Mama. Help me. In a delirium of terror, I leaned against the truck door, and then let myself drop, trembling, onto the running board. I tried to persuade myself that none of this was happening, that it was all a nightmare from which I would wake to see another horizon. As I sat and thought, I still had no idea of the extent of irremediable evil. I dreamed of what life would be like when I shook off this horrible nightmare in which my friend had just died. But my eyes could see only mud, sucking at my boots. Two heads looked out from the back of the truck. They were saying something, but I didn't hear them. I stood up, and turning my back on them, walked off a short distance. That small physical effort reawakened some sense of life and hope, and I tried to tell myself that all of this wasn't really serious, that it was only a bad dream I had to forget. I tried to impose an expression of smiling derision on my features. Two of the wounded men jumped down from the truck to relieve themselves. I stared at them unseeing, while the vitality of being alive beat back the darkness. I began to think with hope that surely all the German soldiers in Russia would be sent to help us, that something must be coming to help us. Suddenly I thought of the French. They were already on their way, all our newspapers said so. The first legionnaires had already set out. I had seen the photographs. I felt a hot flush run through me. Ernst would be avenged, that poor fool who had never hurt a fly, who had spent his time making life more endurable for wretched soldiers shaking with cold. And his marvelous hot showers. The French would come, and I would run to embrace them. Ernst had loved them like his own compatriots. This surge of help and joy could not be damped by facts I didn't know, like the fact that the French had decided on quite another course. "What's happened?" asked one of the men, whose grey bandage was falling over his eyes. "Are we out of gas?" "No, my friend has just been killed." They looked into the cabin. "Fuck. That's not so bad. At least he didn't have to suffer." I knew that Ernst's agony had lasted for nearly half an hour. "We ought to bury him," one of them said. The three of us lifted out the body, which was already stiffening. I moved like an automaton, and my face was without expression. I saw a small rise of ground which was less trampled than everywhere else, and we took Ernst there. We had no shovels, so we dug the grave with our helmets, rifle butts, and bare hands. I myself collected Ernst's identity tags and papers. The other two were already pushing back the dirt, and trampling it down with their boots when I looked my last on that mutilated face. I felt that something had hardened in my spirit forever. Nothing could be worse than this. We pushed in a stick at the head of the grave, and hung Ernst's helmet on it. I slit the stick with the point of my bayonet, and slid in a piece of paper torn from the notebook Ernst always carried with him, inscribed naively in French, "Ici gentleman ami, Ernst Neubuck." Then, to forestall another emotional crisis, I turned and ran back to the truck. We started off again. One of the wounded had come to the front and taken Ernst's place, a stupid-looking man, who fell asleep almost at once. 10 minutes later, the motor coughed, and then died. The jolt woke my sleeping companion. "Something wrong with the engine?" "No," I said in an offhand voice. "We're out of gas." "Shit. So what'll we do?" "We'll walk. On this nice sunny day it should be grand. The strongest will have to help the others." My friend's death had abruptly turned me into a cynic, and I felt almost glad that the others would have to suffer with me. My companion looked me up and down. "You don't mean that. We can't walk. We're all burning up with fever." His stupid assurance made me furious. He was clearly a half-wit who never questioned anything, and had gone to war because he'd been sent. Then a Russian shell had gone off too close, and he'd been pierced, and that is all he felt or knew. Since then, he'd been dozing and stuffing himself with sulfanilamide. "Well, you can stay here, and wait for help, or for Ivan. I'm clearing out." I ran to the back door, kicked it open, and explained the situation. Inside, it stank. The men were lying in a revolting mess. Some of them didn't even hear me, and I felt ashamed and brutal. But what else was there to do? 7 or 8 haggard men pulled themselves up. Their faces were amazingly drawn. Shaggy beards sprouted from their lion cheeks, and their eyes burned with fever. I felt sickened, and unwilling to insist that they walk. When they had climbed down, they discussed the fate of the others. "It's impossible to get them up. Let's just leave without telling them. Maybe someone will be along to help them. They're still coming behind us." Our wretched group set off, haunted by the dying men we had abandoned in the Tatra. But what else could we have done? I was the only man without an injury, and the only man with a gun. I had offered Neubuck's gun, but no one wanted to carry it. A short time later, a muddy sidecar caught up with us, and stopped, although we hadn't flagged them. It carried 2 soldiers who belonged to an armored unit, 2 generous men. One of them decided to give his place to a wounded man, and, collecting his belongings, got out and walked with us. Somehow, the sidecar managed to take on 3 wounded. And so once more I had a strong young man to keep me company, whose humane gesture, if nothing else, made him a sympathetic human being. I no longer remember his name, but I do remember that we talked long and deeply about many things. He told me that the Russian offensive had been mounted very suddenly, and that throughout this vast region we might be stopped at any moment by a Russian motorized unit. My throat went dry, but my companion seemed sure of himself, and of our army. We'll resume the offensive now that it's spring. We'll throw the Popovs back across the Don, and then the Volga. It's astonishing how agreeable it is to meet confidence and enthusiasm when one is feeling lost. It was as if heaven had sent me this healthy animal to revive my morale. I would have liked things more if Nubuck had still been alive, but one must remain humble and resigned in the face of providence. After all, it was I who should have been driving instead of Nubuck. Toward evening, we came to an isolated country farmhouse. We approached cautiously. The partisans often used places like this. They had the same choice as we did, and for anyone a roof is a roof. The tall young man who had joined us walked out ahead, slowly and deliberately, with his hand on his gun. For a moment he disappeared behind the farmyard buildings, and we felt a twinge of anxiety. But he reappeared and waved us on. The farm was inhabited by a group of Russians who did everything they could to make the wounded men comfortable. The women cooked us a hot meal. They told us that they hated communism. They had been deported from a small farm they had owned in the neighborhood of Vitebsk to work on the big kolkhoz we were now walking through. They said they had often given shelter to German soldiers. They had an amphibious VW in one of their sheds, which had broken down and been abandoned by one of our sections. They said that the partisans never bothered them because they knew that the Wehrmacht often used their buildings. Our tall newcomer felt somewhat uneasy about the VW. The Russians might be lying. They could have stolen it. We tried to start it, but although the engine turned over, the vehicle wouldn't move. "We'll fix it tomorrow," the big man said. "We ought to rest now. I'll take the first watch, and you can relieve me at midnight." "We're going to stand watch?" I asked in surprise. "We have to. You can't trust these people. All Russians are liars." This meant another night of anxiety. I walked to the back of the shed, which was dark. There was a jumble of sacks, sheaves of dried sunflower stalks, ropes, and boards, which I arranged as a rough bed. I was about to take off my boots when my companion stopped me. "Don't do that. You'll never be able to stand them tomorrow. You have to let them dry on your feet." I was on the point of replying that the sodden leather would prevent my feet from drying. But I didn't. What difference did it make if my feet were wet or my boots were wet? I myself was soaked through and filthy and so tired. "You should wash your feet, though. That will make you feel fresher, and better tomorrow, too." What sort of a fellow was this? He was as dirty as I, but he seemed to be full of will and ardor and spirit, as if nothing fundamental to his being had been damaged. "I'm too tired," I said. He laughed. I threw myself down on my back, overcome by the exhaustion which ached in the muscles of my shoulders and neck. I stared into the shadows, caught by an indefinable fear. Above me, the dusty beams were lost in the darkness. My sleep was leaden and dreamless. Only happy people have nightmares, from overeating. For those who live a nightmare reality, sleep is a black hole, lost in time, like death. A movement of air shook my heavy head. I sat up slowly. It was already broad daylight, and the sky was shining through the wide door of the shed. Beside the door, next to a large chest, my companion of yesterday sat slumped in sleep. I jumped up like a shot. The idea crossed my mind that he might already be dead. I had learned that life and death can be so close that one can pass from one to the other without attracting any attention. The fresh morning air was shaken by the sound of explosions. I went over to the other soldier and shook him vigorously. He groaned like a drunk who is being questioned. "Wake up." This time he stood up in a single movement. His sleep had exploded like a bomb. Instinctively he reached for his gun. I felt almost afraid. "Yes? Dot. What is it?" he asked. "Tufel, it's daylight. I fell asleep on guard, god damn it." He looked so furious that I kept myself from laughing. His inadequate vigilance had given us both a good night's sleep. Suddenly he pointed his gun at the open door. Before I could turn around, I heard a foreign voice, and one of the Russians who had received us the day before came and stood in the doorway. "Kamerad," he repeated in German. "This morning no good. Boom boom pretty close,